What I need is someone to witness a coronation. Someone with enough power that the witnessing will matter. You. It will happen at Baelkin's feast, tomorrow eve. If you'll just allow it to happen and give your oath to the new High King.
No offense, Kay says. But what do you have to do with any of this? Why do you care who gets the throne?
Because this is where I live, I say. This is where I grew up. Even if I hate it half the time, it's mine. Lord Roybin nods slowly.
And you're not going to tell me who this candidate is, nor how you're going to get a crown on his head?
I'd rather not, I say.
I could get Dulcamera to hurt you, until you begged to be allowed to tell me your secrets.
He says this mildly. Just another fact. But it reminds me of just how horrific his reputation is. No amount of takeout Chinese food or politeness ought to make me forget exactly who and what I am dealing with. Wouldn't that make you as much of a coward as Baelkin? I ask. Trying to project the same confidence I did in the Court of Shadows. The same confidence I did with Cardin. I can't let him see that I'm scared, or, at least, not how scared I am. We study each other for a long moment, the pixie watching us both. Finally, Lord Roybin lets out a long breath.
Probably more of a coward. Very well, Jude, Kingmaker. We will gamble with you. Put the crown on a head other than Baelkin's, and I will help you keep it there.
He pauses.
But you will do something for me.
I wait, tense. He steeples his long fingers.
Someday, I will ask your king for a favor.
You want me to agree to something without even knowing what it is? I blurt out. His stoic face gives little away.
Now we understand each other exactly.
I nod. What choice do I have? Something of equal value, I clarify. And within our power.
This has been a most interesting meeting,
Lord Roybin says, with a small, inscrutable smile. As I stand to leave, Kay winks an ink-drop eye at me.
Luck, mortal.
With her words echoing after me, I leave the encampments and head back to Cardin. Chapter 28. The ghost is up when we return. He had been out and brought back with him a handful of tiny apples, some dried venison, fresh butter, and several dozen more bottles of wine. He's also brought down a few pieces of furniture I recognize from the palace. A silk-embroidered divan, satin cushions, a shimmering spider silk throw, and a chalcedony set of tea things. He looks up from the divan where he is sitting, appearing both tense and exhausted. I think he's grieving, but not in a human way.
Well, I believe I was promised gold.
What if I could promise you revenge? I ask, conscious once again of the weight of debts already on my shoulders. He trades a look with the balm.
So, she really does have a scheme.
The balm settles herself on a cushion. A secret, which is far better than a scheme. I grab an apple, go to the table, and then hoist myself onto it. We're going to walk right into Baelkin's feast and steal his kingdom out from under him.
How's that for vengeance?
Bold. That's what I need to be. Like I own the place. Like I am the general's daughter. Like I can really pull this off. The corner of the ghost's mouth turns up. He takes out four silver cups from the cupboard and sets them before me.
Drink?
I shake my head, watching him pour. He returns to the divan, but rests at the edge, as though he's going to have to jump up in a moment. He takes a big swallow of wine. You spoke of the murder of Dane's unborn child, I say. The ghost nods.
I saw your face when Cardin spoke of Liriope, and when you understood my part in it.
It surprised me, I say honestly. I wanted to think Dane was different. Cardin snorts and takes the silver cup that was meant for me as well as his own.
Murder is a cruel trade, says the ghost. I believe Dane would have been as fair a high king as any prince of the folk. But my father was mortal. He would not have considered Dane to be good. He would not have considered me good, either. You do well to decide how much you care for goodness before you go too far down the road of spycraft.
He's probably right, but there's little time for me to consider it now. You don't understand, I tell him. Liriope's child lived. He turns to the bomb, clearly astonished.
That's the secret?
She nods, a little smug. That's the scheme. The ghost gives her a long look and then turns his gaze to me.
I don't want to find a new position. I want to stay here and serve the next High King. So yes, let's steal the kingdom.
We don't need to be good, I tell the ghost. But let's try to be fair. As fair as any prince of fairy. The ghost smiles. And maybe a little fairer, I say, with a look at Cardin. The ghost nods.
I'd like that.
Then he goes to wake the roach. I have to explain all over again. Once I get to the part about the banquet and what I think is going to happen, the roach interrupts me so many times I can barely get a sentence out. After I'm done speaking, he removes a roll of vellum and a nibbed pen from one of the cabinets, and notes down who ought to be where at what point for the plan to work. You're replanning my plan, I say.
Just a little, he says,
licking the nib and beginning to write again.
Are you concerned over Maddock? He won't like this.
Of course I am concerned about Maddock. If I wasn't, I wouldn't be doing any of this. I would just hand him the living key to the kingdom. I know, I say, gazing at the dregs of wine in the ghost's glass. The moment I walk into the feast with Cardin on my arm, Maddock will know I am running a game of my own. When he discovers that I am going to cheat him out of being regent, he'll be furious. And he's at his most bloodthirsty when he's furious.
Do you have something appropriate to wear?
The roach asks. At my surprised look, he throws up his hands.
You're playing politics. You and Cardin need to be turned out in splendor for this banquet. Your new king will need everything to look right.
We go over the plans again, and Cardin helps us map out Hollow Hall. I try not to be too conscious of his long fingers tracing over the paper, of the sick thrill I get when he looks at me. At dawn, I drink 3 cups of tea and set out alone for the last person I must speak with before the banquet. My sister, Vivienne. I go back to my house. Maddock's house. I remind myself, never really mine. Never mine again after tonight. As the sun rises in a blaze of gold, I feel like a shadow as I climb the spiral stairs. As I pass through all the rooms I grew up in. In my bedroom, I pack a bag. Poison, knives, a gown, and jewels that I think the roach will find to be properly extravagant. With reluctance, I leave behind the stuffed animals from my bed. I leave slippers and books and my favorite baubles. I step out of my second life the same way I stepped out of my first, holding too few things and with great uncertainty about what will happen next. Then I go to Vivi's door. I rap softly. After a few moments, she sleepily lets me inside.
Oh, good, she mumbles, yawning. You're packed.
Then she catches sight of my face and shakes her head.
Please don't tell me you're not coming.
Something happened, I say, resting my bag on the ground. I keep my voice low. There is no real reason to hide that I am here, but hiding has become habit. Just hear me out.
You disappeared,
she says.
I've been waiting and waiting for you, trying to act like things were fine in front of Dad. You made me worry.
I know, I say. She looks at me like she's considering giving me a swift smack.
I was afraid you were dead.
I'm not even a little bit dead, I say, taking her arm and pulling her close so I can speak in a whisper. But I have to tell you something I know you're not going to like. I have been working as a spy for Prince Dane. He put me under a geish, so I couldn't have said anything before his death. Her delicately pointed eyebrows rise.
Spying? What does that entail?
Sneaking around and getting information.
Killing people.
And before you say anything else, I was good at it.
Okay,
she says. She knew something was up with me, but from her face, I can tell that in a million years, she wouldn't have guessed this. I go on, and I discovered that Matic is going to make a political move, one that involves Oak. I explain once more about Liriope and Oriana and Dane. By this point, I have told this story enough that it's easy to hit only the necessary parts, to run through the information quickly and convincingly. Matic is going to make Oak king and himself regent. I don't know if that was always his plan, but I'm sure it's his plan now.
And that's why you're not coming to the human world with me?
I want you to take Oak instead, I tell her. Keep him away from all this until he gets a little older. Old enough not to need a regent. I'll stay here and make sure he has something to come back to. Vivi puts her hands on her hips, a gesture that reminds me of our mother.
And how exactly are you going to do that?
Leave that part to me, I say, wishing that Vivi didn't know me quite as well as she does. To distract her, I explain about Baelkin's banquet, about how the Court of Shadows is going to help me get the crown. I am going to need her to prep Oak for the coronation. Whoever controls the king, controls the kingdom, I say. If Matic is regent, you know that Faerie will always be at war.
So, let me get this straight. You want me to take Oak away from Faerie, away from everyone he knows, and teach him to be a good king?
She laughs mirthlessly.
Our mother once stole a Faerie child away. Me. You know what happened. How will this be any different? How will you keep Matic and Baelkin from hunting Oak to the ends of the earth?
Someone can be sent to guard him, to guard all of you. But, as for the rest, I have a plan. Matic won't follow. With Vivi, I feel forever doomed to be the little sister, foolish and about to topple over onto my face.
Maybe I don't want to play nursemaid,
Vivi says.
Maybe I will lose him in a parking garage, or forget him at school. Maybe I would teach him awful tricks. Maybe he would blame me for all this.
Give me another solution. You really think this is what I want? I know I sound like I am pleading with her, but I can't help it. For a tense moment, we look at each other. Then she sits down hard in a chair and lets her head fall back against the cushion.
How am I going to explain this to Heather?
I think Oak is the least shocking part of what you have to tell her, I say. And it's just for a few years. You're immortal, which, by the way, is one of the more shocking things you have to tell her. She gives me a glare fit to singe hair.
Make me a promise that this is going to save Oak's life.
I promise, I tell her.
And make me another promise that it's not going to cost you yours.
I nod. It won't.
Liar,
she says.
You're a dirty liar, and I hate it. And I hate this.
Yeah, I say. I know. At least she didn't say she hated me, too. I am on my way out of the house when Taryn opens her bedroom door. She's dressed in a skirt the color of ivy, with stitching picking out a pattern of falling leaves. My breath catches. I wasn't planning to see her. We regard each other for a long moment. She takes in that there's a bag over my shoulder, and that I'm in the same clothes I wore when we fought. Then she closes her door again, leaving me to my fate. Chapter 29. Never have I walked through the front doors of Hollow Hall. Always before I have come skulking through the kitchens, dressed as a servant. Now I stand in front of the polished wooden doors, lit by two lamps of trapped sprites who fly in desperate circles. They illuminate a carving of an enormous and sinister face. The knocker, a circle piercing its nose. Cardin reaches for it, and because I have grown up in Faerie, I am not entirely surprised into a scream when the door's eyes open.
"My prince,"
it says.
"My door,"
he says in return, with a smile that conveys both affection and familiarity. It's bizarre to see his obnoxious charm used for something other than evil.
"Hail and welcome,"
the door says, swinging open to reveal one of Baelkin's fairy servants. He stares open-mouthed at Cardin, missing Prince of Faerie.
"The other guests are through there,"
the servant finally manages. Cardin tucks my arm firmly through his before striding into the entryway, and I feel a rush of warmth as I match his step. I can't afford to be less than ruthlessly honest with myself. Against my better judgment, despite the fact that he is terrible, Cardin is also fun. Maybe I should be glad of how little it will matter. But for now, it's immensely unnerving. Cardin is dressed in a suit of Dane's clothes, stolen from the palace wardrobes and altered by a clever-fingered brownie that owed the roach a gambling debt. He looks regal in different shades of cream, a coat over a vest and loose shirt, breeches and a neckcloth, with the same silver-tipped boots he wore to the coronation, a single sapphire shining from his left ear. He's supposed to look regal. I helped choose the clothes, helped make him this way. And yet the effect is not lost on me. I am wearing a bottle green gown with earrings in the shape of berries. In my pocket is Liriope's golden acorn. And at my hip is my father's sword. Against my skin, I have a collection of knives. It doesn't feel like enough. As we cross the floor, everyone turns to look. The lords and ladies of Faerie. Kings and queens of other courts. The representative from the Queen of the Undersea. Baelkin. My family. Oak. Standing with Orianna and Madoc. I look over at Lord Roybin, his white hair making him easy to find in the crowd. But he does not acknowledge that we have ever met. His face remains unreadable. A mask. I'm going to have to trust that he will keep his part of the bargain. But I mislike this kind of calculation. I grew up thinking of strategy as finding weaknesses and exploiting them. That I understand. But making people like you, making people want to take your part and be on your side, that I am far less skilled at. My gaze goes from a table of refreshments to the elaborate gowns to a goblin king crunching on a bone. Then my eyes settle on the blood crown of the High King. It rests on a ledge above us, a pillow beneath it. There, it glows with a sinister light. At the sight, I imagine all my plans coming apart. The thought of stealing it, in front of everyone, daunts me. And yet, having to search Hollow Hall for it would have been daunting too. I see Baelkin move from speaking with a woman I don't recognize. She's wearing a gown of woven seaweed and a collar of pearls. Her black hair is tied to a crown festooned with more pearls, appearing like webbing above her head. It takes me a moment to puzzle out who she must be. Queen Orla.
Nikasia's mother.
Thalkin leaves her and crosses the room toward us with purpose. Cardin catches sight of Thalkin and steers us in the direction of the wine. Bottles and carafes of it. Pale green, yellow as gold, the dark purple red of my heart's own blood. They are redolent of roses, of dandelions, of crushed herbs and currants. The smell alone nearly makes my head spin.
Little brother,
Thalkin says to Cardin. He is dressed head to toe in black and silver. The velvet of his doublet so thickly embroidered with patterns of crowns and birds that it looks as heavy as armor. He wears a silver circlet on his brow, matching his eyes. It's not the crown, but it is a crown.
I've sought high and low for you. Doubtless so.
Cardin smiles like the villain I've always believed him to be.
I turned out to be useful after all. What a terrible surprise.
Prince Thalkin smiles back as though their smiles could duel without the rest of them even being involved. I am sure he wishes he could rail at Cardin, could beat him into doing what he wants. But since the rest of their family died at sword point, Thalkin must have learned his lesson about needing a willing participant in a coronation. For the moment, Cardin's presence is enough to reassure people that Thalkin will soon be the High King. If Thalkin calls for guards or grabs him, that illusion will dissipate.
And you,
Thalkin says, turning his gaze to me, viciousness lighting his eyes.
What have you to do with this? Leave us. Jude,
Maddox says, striding up to stand beside Prince Thalkin, who immediately seems to realize, I might have something to do with this after all. Maddox looks displeased, but not alarmed. I am sure he is thinking me a fool who expects to get a pat on the head for finding the missing prince, and cursing himself for not making it more clear that he wanted Cardin brought to him and not to Thalkin. I give him my best blithe smile, like a girl who thinks she has solved everyone's problems. How frustrating it must be to come so close to your goal, to have Oak and the crown in one place, to have the lords and ladies of Faerie assembled. And then your first wife's bastard throws a spanner in the works by handing the one person most likely to put the crown on Oak's head to your rival. I note the evaluating look he's giving Cardin, however. He's replanning. He rests a heavy hand on my shoulder.
You found him.
He turns to Thalkin.
I hope you're intending to reward my daughter. I am sure it took no small amount of persuasion to bring him here.
Cardin gives Maddox an odd look. I remember what he said about it bothering him that Maddox treated me so well when Eldred barely acknowledged him. But the way he's looking, I wonder if it's just weird to see us together. Red Cap General and Human Girl.
I will give her anything she asks for, and more.
Thalkin promises extravagantly. I see Maddox frown, and I give him a quick smile, pouring two glasses of wine. One light, and the other dark. I am careful with them, sly-fingered. I do not spill a drop. Instead of handing one to Cardin, I offer them both up for Maddox to choose between. Smiling, he takes the one the color of heart's blood. I take the other. To the future of Faerie, I say, tapping the globes together, making the glass ring like bells. We drink. Immediately I feel the effects, a kind of floatiness, as though I am swimming through air. I don't want to even look at Cardin. He will laugh and laugh if he thinks I can't handle a few sips of wine. Cardin pours his own glass and throws it back.
Take the bottle,
Thalkin says.
I am prepared to be very generous. Let us discuss what you'd like. Whatever you'd like.
There's no hurry, is there?
Cardin asks lazily. Balekin gives him the hard stare of someone barely holding himself back from violence.
I think everyone would like to see the matter settled.
Nonetheless, Cardin says, taking the bottle of wine and drinking directly from the neck.
We have all night.
The power is in your hands,
Balekin tells him, in a clipped way that leaves the, for now, heavily implied. I see a muscle twitch in Cardin's jaw. I am sure Balekin is imagining how he will punish Cardin for any delay. It weighs down his every word. Matic, by contrast, is taking in the situation, evaluating, no doubt, what he can offer Cardin. When he smiles at me and takes another swig of his wine, it's a real smile, toothy and relieved. I can see he's thinking that Cardin will be easier to manipulate than Balekin ever would have been. I'm suddenly certain that if we went into the other room, Balekin would find Matic's sword buried in his chest.
After dinner, I will tell you my terms,
Cardin says.
But until then, I am going to enjoy the party.
I do not have endless patience,
Balekin growls.
Cultivate it,
Cardin says. And with a small bow, he navigates us away from Balekin and Matic. I leave my glass of wine near a platter of sparrow hearts, pierced through with long silver pins, and weave through the crowd with him. Nikasia stops us with a long-fingered hand against Cardin's chest, her cerulean hair bright against her bronze gown.
Where have you been?
Nikasia asks, with a glance at our linked arms. She wrinkles her delicate nose, but panic underlines her words. She is feigning calm, like the rest of us. I am sure that she thought Cardin had to be dead. Or worse. There must be many things she wants to ask him, all of which she cannot do in front of me.
Jude here made me her prisoner,
he says, and I have to fight down the urge to step heavily on his foot.
She ties very tight knots.
Nikasia clearly doesn't know whether to laugh. I almost sympathize. I don't know either.
Good thing you finally managed to slip her bonds,
Nikasia decides on. He raises both brows.
Did I?
He asks, with a haughty condescension, as though she has shown herself to be less clever than he had hoped.
Must you be like this, even now?
She asks, clearly deciding to throw caution to the wind. Her hand goes to his arm. His face softens in a way that I am entirely unused to seeing.
Nikasia,
he says, pulling himself free.
Stay away from me tonight, for your own sake.
It stings a little, that he has that kindness in him. I don't want to see it. She gives me a look, doubtlessly trying to decide why his pronouncement doesn't apply to me. But then Cardin is moving away from her, and I go with him. I see Taryn across the room, Locke beside her. Her eyes widen, taking in whom I am standing with. Something passes over her face, and it looks a lot like resentment. She has Locke, but I am here with a prince. That's not fair. I cannot know she is thinking that from just one look. Part one completed, I say, looking away from her. Speaking to Cardin under my breath. We got here, got in, and are not yet in chains.
Yes, he says. I believe the Roach called that the easy bit.
The plan, as I've explained it to him, has five basic phases. One, get in. Two, get everybody else in. Three, get the crown. Four, put the crown on Oak's head. And five, get out. I take my arm from his. Don't go anywhere alone, I remind Cardin. He gives me the tight-lipped smile of someone who's being abandoned, and nods once. I head toward Oriana and Oak. On the other side of the room, I see Severin break off from a conversation and walk toward Prince Balekin. Sweat beads on my lip, under my arms. My muscles tense. If Severin says the wrong thing, I am going to have to abandon all phases of the plan except for get out. Oriana raises both brows as I approach, her hands going to Oak's thin shoulders. He reaches up his hands. I want to swing him up into my arms. I want to ask him if Vivi explained what's going to happen. I want to tell him everything's going to be fine. But Oriana grabs his fingers, pressing them between hers, settling the question of how many lies I could stomach. What is this? Oriana asks me, with a nod toward Cardan. What you asked, I tell her, following her gaze. Somehow, Baelkin has drawn Cardan into his conversation with Severin. Cardan laughs at something Baelkin said, looking as comfortably arrogant as I've ever seen him. I am shocked by recognition. If you live your life always afraid, always with danger on your heels, it is not so difficult to pretend away more danger. I know that. But I didn't think, of all people, Cardan would too. Baelkin has his hand on Cardin's shoulder. I can just imagine his fingers digging into Cardin's neck. It's not easy. I hope you understand there's going to be a price. I'll pay it, she says quickly. None of us knows the cost, I snap, and then hope no one notices the sharpness of my tone. And we're all going to have to pay our share. My skin has a fine flush on it from the wine, and there's a metallic taste in my mouth. It's nearly time to put the next part of the plan into effect. I glance around for Vivi, but she's across the room. There's no time to say anything to her now, even if I knew what to say. I give Oak what I hope is an encouraging smile. I have often wondered if my past is the reason I am the way I am, if it has made me monstrous. If so, will I make a monster out of him? Vivi won't. I tell myself. Her job is to help him care about things other than power. And my job is to care only about power so I can carve out room for his return. With a deep breath, I head toward the doors out into the hallway. I pass the pair of knights and turn a corner, out of their sight line. I gulp down a few breaths before unlatching the windows. I wait a few hopeful moments. If the roach and the ghost climb through, I can explain the crown's location. But instead, the doors to the banquet open, and I hear Matic order the knights off. I move so that he can see me. When he does, he comes toward me with purpose.
Jude, I thought you came this way.
I needed some fresh air, I tell him, which is indicative of how nerved up I am. I have answered the question he hasn't yet asked. He waves it off, though.
You should have come to me first, when you found Prince Cardan. We could have negotiated from a position of strength.
I thought you might say something like that, I tell him.
What matters now is that I need to speak with him alone. I'd like you to go inside and bring him out here, so we can talk. All three of us can talk.
I move away from the window, into the open space of the hall. The ghost and the roach will be here in a moment, and I don't want Matic to spot them. About Oak, I ask. As I had hoped, Matic follows me away from the window, frowning.
You knew.
That you have a plan for ruling Elfheim yourself? I ask him. I figured it out. He stares at me as though I am a stranger. But I have never felt less like one. For the first time... We are both unmasked.
And yet, you brought Prince Cardan here, right to Baelkin,
he says.
Or to me, is that it? Are we to bargain now?
It must be one or the other. Right, I say. He's growing angry.
Would you prefer no High King at all? If the crown is destroyed, there will be war. And if there's war, I will win it. One way or another, I will have that crown, Jude. And you stand to benefit when I do. There's no reason to oppose me. You can have your knighthood. You can have all the things you've ever dreamed of.
He takes another step toward me. We are in striking distance of each other. You said, I will have that crown. You, I remind him. My hand going to the hilt of my sword. You've barely spoken Oak's name. He is just a means to an end, and that end is power. Power for you.
Jude,
he begins, but I cut him off. I'll make a bargain. Swear to me that you'll never raise a hand against Oak. And I'll help. Promise me that when he comes of age, you will immediately step down as regent. You'll give him whatever power you'll have amassed, and you'll do it willingly. Maddox's mouth twists, his hands fist. I know he loves Oak. He loves me. I'm sure he loved my mother, too, in his own way. But he is who and what he is. I know he cannot promise. I draw my sword, and he does, too. The scrape of metal loud in the room. I hear distant laughter, but here in the hall, we are alone. My hands are sweating, but this has the feeling of inevitability, as though this is what I was careening toward the whole time. My whole life.
You can't beat me,
Maddox says, moving into a fighting stance. I already have, I say.
You have no way to win.
Maddox flicks his blade, encouraging me to come toward him, as though this is just some practice bout.
What can you hope to do with one missing prince, here in Belkin's stronghold? I will knock you down, and then I will take him from you. You could have had anything you wanted. But now you will be left with nothing.
Oh, yes. Let me tell you my whole plan. You've goaded me right into it. I make a face. Let's not stall anymore. This is the part where we fight.
At least you're no coward.
He rushes at me with such force that even though I block the blow, I am thrown to the floor. I roll into a standing position, but I am shaken. He has never fought me like this, full out. This will be no genteel exchange of blows. He's the High King's general. I knew he was better than me, but not how much better. I cheat a glance toward the window. I can't be stronger than him, but I don't need to be. I just need to keep on my feet a little while longer. I strike out, hoping to catch him by surprise. He knocks me back again. I dodge and turn, but he expects the blow. And I have to stumble inelegantly back, blocking yet another heavy chop of his blade. My arms hurt from the strength behind his blows. This is all happening too fast. I come in with a series of techniques he's taught me, and then use a bit of swordplay I learned from the ghost. I feign left, and then land a clever slice to his side. It's a shallow hit, but it surprises us both when a line of red wets his coat. He thrusts toward me. I jump to one side, and he elbows me in the face, knocking me back to the ground. Blood gushes over my mouth from my nose. I push myself dizzily to my feet. I'm scared, no matter how I try to play it off. I was arrogant. I am trying to buy time, but one of his blows could split me in half.
Surrender,
he tells me. Sword pointed toward my throat.
It was well tried. I will forgive you, Jude, and we will go back into the banquet. You will persuade Cardin to do what I need him to. All will be as it should be.
I spit blood on the stone tiles. His sword arm trembles a little. You surrender, I say. He laughs, as though I have told a particularly rich joke. Then he stops, grimacing. I imagine you're not feeling quite yourself, I tell him. His sword sags a little, and he looks at me in sudden comprehension.
What
have you done?
I poisoned you. Don't worry. It was a small enough dose. You'll live.
The cups of wine,
he says.
But how did you know which one I would choose?
I didn't, I tell him, thinking that he'll be at least a little pleased by the answer, despite himself. It is the kind of strategy he likes best. I poisoned them both.
You will be very sorry,
he says. The tremble is in his legs now. I know. I feel the echo of it in my own. But by now, I am used to drinking poison. I look deep into his eyes as I sheathe my sword. Father, I am what you made me. I've become your daughter, after all. Maddock lifts his blade again, as though he's going to rush at me one final time. But then it falls from his hand, and he falls too, sprawling on the stone floor. When the ghost and the roach come in, a few tense minutes later, they find me sitting beside him, too tired to even think of moving his body. Wordlessly, the roach hands me a handkerchief, and I start to wipe the blood from my nose.
On to phase 3,
the ghost says. Chapter 30. When I rejoin the feast, everyone is taking their place at the long table. I walk straight to Baelkin and curtsy. My lord, I say, pitching my voice low. Maddock asked me to tell you that he is delayed and to begin without him. He wishes you not to worry, but some of Dane's spies are here. He will send you word when he's caught or killed them. Baelkin regards me with slightly pursed lips and narrowed eyes. He takes in whatever traces of blood I couldn't wash from my nostrils and my teeth, whatever sweat I couldn't wipe away. Maddock slumbers in Cardin's old room, and by my calculations, we have at least an hour before he wakes. It feels as though if Baelkin looked carefully, he could see that on my face too.
You have been more helpful than I would have guessed,
Baelkin says, resting a hand lightly on my shoulder. He seems to have forgotten how furious he was when I first came in with Cardin and expects me to forget too.
Continue, and you will find yourself rewarded. Would you like to live as one of us? Would you like to be one of us?
Could the High King of Faerie really give me that? Could he make me something other than human? Something other than mortal? I think of Valyrian's words when he tried to glamour me into jumping out of the tower. Being born mortal is like being born already dead. He sees the look on my face and smiles, sure that he has ferreted out the secret desire of my heart. And indeed, as I walk to my seat, I am troubled. I should feel triumphant. But instead, I feel sick. Outmaneuvering Maddock wasn't nearly as satisfying as I wanted it to be, especially since I was able to do it because he never thought of me as someone who would betray him. Perhaps years from now, my faith in this plan will prove justified. But until then, I will have to live with this acid in the pit of my stomach. The future of Faerie depends on my playing a long game and playing it perfectly. I spot Vivi, sitting between Nicasia and Lord Severin, and I give her a quick smile. She gives me a grim one in return. Lord Roybin looks at me askance. Beside him, the green pixie whispers something in his ear, and he shakes his head. At the other end of the table, Locke kisses Taryn's hand. Queen Orla looks over at me curiously. There are only 3 mortals here. Taryn, me, and the redhead with Severin. And from the way she regards us, Orla is imagining mice presiding over a convocation of cats. Above hangs a chandelier made from thin sheets of mica. Tiny glowing fairies are trapped inside for the purpose of adding a warm glow to the room. Occasionally, they fly, making shadows dance.
Jude,
Locke says, touching my arm, startling me. His fox eyes crinkle in amusement.
I admit, I am a little jealous to see Cardin parading you around on his arm.
I take a step back. I don't have time for this.
I liked you, you know,
he says.
I like you still.
For a moment, I wonder what would happen if I hauled off and punched him. Go away, Locke, I tell him. His smile returns.
The thing I like best is how you never do what I imagine you will. For instance, I didn't think you'd duel over me.
I didn't. I pull away from him and head to the table, a little unsteady on my feet.
There you are,
Cardin says as I take my place beside him.
How has the night been going for you? Mine has been full of dull conversations about how my head is going to find itself on a spike.
My hands shake as I take my place. I tell myself that it's just the poison. My mouth is dry. I find myself without the wit for verbal sparring. Servants set down dishes, roasted goose shining with currant glaze, oysters and stewed ramps, acorn cakes and whole fish stuffed with rose hips. Wine is poured, dark green with pieces of gold floating in it. I watch them sink to the bottom of the glass, shining sediment.
Have I told you how hideous you look tonight?
Cardin asks, leaning back in the elaborately carved chair. The warmth of his words turning the question into something like a compliment. No, I say, glad to be annoyed back into the present. Tell me.
I cannot,
he says, then frowns.
Jude.
I may never be used to the sound of my name on his lips. His brows draw together.
There's a bruising coming up on your jaw.
I take a deep drink of water. I'm fine, I tell him.
It's not long now.
Baelkin stands and raises his glass. I shove back my chair so that I am on my feet when the explosion happens. For a moment, everything is so loud, it feels like the room is tilting sideways. The folk scream. Crystal goblets fall and shatter. The bomb has struck. In the confusion, a single black bolt flies from a shadowed alcove and sinks into the wooden table right in front of Cardin. Baelkin leaps to his feet.
There!
He shouts.
The assassin!
Knights run toward the roach, who leaps out of the gloom and shoots again. Another bolt flies toward Cardin, who pretends to be too stunned to move. Just the way we practiced. The roach explained to Cardin in great detail how it would be much safer to be still. Much easier to miss him that way. What we didn't count on is Baelkin. He knocks Cardin out of the chair, throws him to the floor, and covers Cardin's body with his own. As I stare at them, I realize how little I've understood their relationship. Because, yes, Baelkin hasn't noticed that the ghost has climbed onto the ledge with the blood crown. Yes, he sent his knights after the roach, allowing the bomb to bar the doors of this room. But he has also reminded Cardin of why not to go forward with this plan. I have been thinking of Baelkin as the brother Cardin hated, as the brother who'd murdered their whole family. I'd forgotten that Baelkin is Cardin's family. Baelkin is the person who raised him when Dane plotted against him, when his father sent him from the palace. Baelkin is all he has left. And although I am sure Baelkin would make for a terrible king, one who would hurt Cardin along with many others, I am equally sure that he would give Cardin power. Cardin would be allowed to be cruel, so long as it was clear that Baelkin was crueler. Putting the crown on Baelkin's head was a safe bet. Much safer than trusting me, than believing in some future oak. He's pledged himself to me. I just need to take care he doesn't find some way around my commands. I am a beat behind, and it's harder to push through the crowd than I thought, so I am not where I told the ghost I would be. When I look up at the ledge, he's there, moving out of the shadow. He throws the crown, but not to me. The ghost tosses the crown to my identical twin. It falls at Taryn's feet. Vivi has taken Oak's hand. Lord Roybin is pushing through the crowd. Taryn picks up the crown. "Give it to Vivi," I call to her. The ghost, realizing his mistake, draws his crossbow and points it at my sister. But there's no way to shoot his way out of this. She gives me a terrible, betrayed look. Cardin struggles to his feet. Baelkin is up too, striding across the room.
"Child, if you do not give that to me, I will cut you in half,"
Baelkin tells Taryn.
"I will be the High King, and when I am, I will punish any who inconvenienced me."
She holds it out, looking between Baelkin and Vivi and me. Then she looks at all the lords and ladies watching her.
"Give me my crown,"
Baelkin says, walking toward her. Lord Roybin steps into Baelkin's path. He presses his hand to Baelkin's chest.
"Wait."
He hasn't drawn a blade, but I see the shine of knives under his coat. Baelkin tries to push Roybin's hand away, but he does not move. The ghost has his crossbow trained on Baelkin, and every eye in the room is watching him. Queen Orla is several steps away. Violence hangs heavily in the air. I move toward Taryn to get in front of her. If Baelkin draws a weapon, if he throws away diplomacy and simply charges, the room seems ready to explode into bloodshed. Some will fight on his side, some against. No vows to the crown matter now, and watching him murder his own family hasn't left anyone feeling safe. He has brought the lords and ladies of Faerie here to win them over. Even he seems to see that more murder is unlikely to do that. Besides, the ghost can shoot him before he gets to Taryn, and he wears no armor under his clothes. No matter how heavy the embroidery, it will not save him from a bolt to the heart.
"She's only a mortal girl,"
he says.
"This is a lovely banquet, Baelkin, son of Eldred," Queen Orla says, "but sadly lacking in amusements before now. Let this be our entertainment. After all, the crown is secure in this room, is it not? And you or your younger brother are the only ones who can wear it. Let the girl choose whom she will give it to. What does it matter if neither of you will crown the other?"
I am surprised. I thought Queen Orla was his ally. But then I suppose Nicasia's friendship with Cardin might have made her favor him. Or perhaps she favors neither of them, and only wants the sea to have greater power, by diminishing the power of the land.
"This is ridiculous," he says. "What of the explosion? Didn't that entertain you sufficiently?"
"It certainly piqued my interest,"
Lord Roybin says.
"You seem to have lost your general somewhere as well. Your rule hasn't even formally begun, but it certainly appears chaotic."
I turn to Taryn and close my fingers over the cool metal of the crown. Up close, it is exquisite. The leaves seem to grow out of the dark gold, to be living things, their stems crossing over one another in a delicate knotwork. "Please," I say. "There's still so much that's bad between us. So much anger and betrayal and jealousy." "What are you doing?" Taryn hisses at me. Behind her, Locke is looking at me with an odd gleam in his eyes. My story just got more interesting, and I know how much he loves story above all else. "The best I can," I say. I tug, and for a long moment, Taryn holds fast. Then she opens her hand, and I stagger back with the crown. Vivi has brought Oak as close as she dares. Oriana stands with the crowd, clasping and unclasping her hands. She must notice Maddox's absence, must be wondering what I meant when I spoke of a price. "Prince Cardin," I say, "this is for you." The crowd parts to let him through. The other key player in this drama. He walks to stand to one side of me and Oak.
"Stop!" Bailkin shouts. "Stop them immediately!"
He draws a blade, clearly no longer interested in playing politics. Around the room, more swords are unsheathed in a terrible echo of his. I can hear the hum of enchanted steel in the air. I reach for Nightfell at the moment the ghost lets his bolt fly. Bailkin staggers back. I hear the sound of indrawn breaths all around the room. Shooting the king, even if he's not wearing a crown, is no small thing. Then, as Bailkin's sword falls to the ancient rug, I see where he was shot. His hand is pinioned to the dining table by a crossbow bolt, one that appears to be iron.
"Cardin,"
Bailkin calls.
"I know you. I know that you'd prefer I did the difficult work of ruling while you enjoyed the power. I know that you despise mortals and ruffians and fools. Come, I have not always danced to your piping, but you haven't the stomach to truly cross me. Bring me the crown!"
I gather Oak close to me and put the crown into his hands, so that he can see it, so that he can get used to holding it. Vivi pats him encouragingly on his back.
"Bring me the crown, Cardin,"
Bailkin says. Prince Cardin turns on his elder brother, the same cool and calculated gaze with which he has regarded so many other creatures before he's torn the wings from their back. Before he's cast them into rivers or sent them from the court entirely.
"No, brother, I do not think that I will. I think that if I did not have another reason to cross you, I would do it for spite."
Oak looks up at me, searching for confirmation that he's doing okay in the face of all this shouting. I nod with an encouraging smile. "Show Oak," I whisper to Cardin. "Show him what he's supposed to do. Kneel down."
"They're going to think..."
he starts, but I interrupt him. "Just do it." Cardin kneels, and a hush goes through the crowd. Swords are returned to sheaths. Movement slow.
"Oh, this is amusing,"
says Lord Roybin in a low voice.
"Who might that child be? Or whose?"
He and Queen Annette share a very unseely smile.
"See?"
Cardin says to Oak, and then makes an impatient gesture.
"Now the crown."
I look around at the lords and ladies of Faerie. Not one of their faces is friendly. All of them appear wary, waiting. Bailkin's expression is wild with fury, and he pulls against the bolt, as though he might rip his hand in half before he allowed this to happen. Oak takes a hesitant step toward Cardin, then another.
"Phase four,"
Cardin whispers to me, still believing we're on the same side. I think of Maddox, dozing away upstairs. All his dreams of murder. I think of Oriana and Oak, being forced apart for years. I think of Cardin and how he will hate me. I think of what it means to make myself the villain of the piece. For the next full minute, I command you not to move, I whisper back. Cardin goes utterly still.
"Go ahead," Vivi says to Oak. "Just like we practiced."
And with that, Oak puts the crown down on Cardin's head to rest on his brow.
"I crown you."
Oak's little kid voice is uncertain.
"King,
High King of Faerie.
His eyes go to Vivi, to Orianna. He's waiting for one of them to tell him he did well, that he is done. People gasp. Baelkin gives a howl of fury. There is laughter and outrage and delight. Everyone likes a surprise. And the folk like one more than almost anything else. Cardan looks at me with helpless rage. Then, the full minute of my command up, he rises slowly to his feet. The fury in his eyes is familiar. The glitter of them like banked fire. Like coals burning hotter than flames ever could. This time, I deserve it. I promised he was going to be able to walk away from the court and all its manipulations. I promised he would be free from all this. I lied. It's not that I don't want Oak to be the High King. I do. He will be. But there's only one way to make sure the throne remains ready for him while he learns everything he needs to know. And that's if someone else occupies it. 7 years, and Cardan can step down, abdicate in Oak's favor, and do whatever he wants. But until then, he's going to have to keep my brother's throne warm. Lord Roybin sinks to one knee, as he promised.
My king,
he says. I wonder what that promise will cost. I wonder what he will ask us for, now that he has helped give Cardan a crown. And then the cry goes up around the room, from Queen Annet to Queen Orla and Lord Severin. From the other side, Taryn stares at me, clearly shocked. To her, I must seem mad to put someone I despise on the throne. But there is no way for me to explain myself. I sink to my knees along with everyone else. And so does she. All my promises have come due. For a long moment, Cardan just looks around the room. But he has little choice, and he must know it. Rise, he says. And we do. I step back, fading into the throng. Cardan has been a prince of Faerie all his life. No matter what he wants, he knows what's expected of him. He knows how to charm a crowd, how to entertain. He orders the broken glass cleared away. He has new goblets brought out, new wine poured. The toast he gives, to surprises and to the benefits of being too drunk to show up for the first coronation, causes all the lords and ladies to laugh. And if I notice that his hand grips his wine glass tightly enough to turn his knuckles white, then I imagine I'm the only one who does. Yet I am surprised when he turns to me, eyes blazing. It feels as though the room is empty but for us. He lifts his glass anew, mouth curving in a mockery of a smile.
And to Jude, who gave me a gift tonight, one that I plan to repay in kind.
I try not to visibly flinch as glasses lift around me. Crystal rings. More wine flows. More laughter sounds. The balm elbows me in the side.
We came up with your code name, she mouths.
I hadn't even seen her come in past the locked doors. What? I feel as tired as I have ever felt. And yet, for 7 years, I will not be able to truly rest. I expect her to say, the liar. She gives me a tricksy grin, full of secrets.
What else? The queen.
It turns out, I still don't know how to laugh. Epilogue. I stand in the middle of Target, pushing the cart while Oak and Vivi pick out bedsheets and lunchboxes, skinny jeans and sandals. Oak looks around in mild confusion, and pleasure. He keeps picking up things, puzzling over them, and then setting them down again. In the candy aisle, He adds bars of chocolate to the cart, along with jelly beans, lollipops, and chunks of candied ginger. Vivi doesn't stop him, so I don't either. It's odd to see Oak with his horns glamored away, his ears looking as round as mine. It's odd to see him in the toy aisle, trying out a scooter with an owl-shaped backpack over one arm. I expected that it would be hard to persuade Oriana to let him go with Vivi, but after Cardin's coronation, she agreed that Oak being away from the court for a few years was for the best. Baelkin is imprisoned in a tower. Madoc woke in a rage, only to find that his moment for seizing the crown was past.
So, he's really your brother, right?
Heather asks Vivi as Oak kicks off on the scooter, flying through the greeting card aisle.
You could tell me if he was your son.
Vivi laughs delightedly. I've got secrets, but that's not one of them. Heather wasn't thrilled about Vivienne showing up with a child and a half-baked explanation about why he had to live with her, but she didn't kick them out. Heather's sofa pulled out into a bed, and they agreed he could sleep there until Vivi found a job and they were able to afford a larger apartment. I know Vivi isn't going to get conventional work, but she will be fine. She will be better than fine. In another world, given our parents and our past, I would have kept on encouraging Vivi to trust Heather with the truth. But for now, if she feels like she has to keep the deception going, I am hardly in a position to contradict her. As we stand in the checkout line and Vivi pays for her haul with leaves glamoured to seem like bills, I think again of the aftermath of the banquet-turned-coronation, of the blur of folk eating and joking, of everyone marveling over Oak, who appeared both pleased and panicked, of Oriana, clearly not sure whether to congratulate me or to slap me, or Taryn, quiet, considering, holding tightly to Locke's hand, of Nikasia giving Cardin a lingering kiss on his royal cheek. I have done the thing, and now I must live with what I have done. I have lied, and I have betrayed, and I have triumphed. If only there was someone to congratulate me. Heather sighs and smiles dreamily at Vivi as we load our purchases into the trunk of Heather's Prius. Back at the apartment, Heather takes some pre-made pizza dough out of her fridge and explains how to make personal pies.
Mom will visit me, won't she?
Oak asks as he places pieces of chocolate and marshmallows on top of his dough. I squeeze his arm as Heather sticks the food in the oven.
Of course she will. Think of being here with Vivi as an apprenticeship. You learn what you need to know, and then you come home.
How will I know when I've learned it, since I don't know it now? He asks.
The question sounds like a riddle.
Come back when returning feels like a hard choice instead of an easy one, I answer finally.
Vivi looks over, as though she's overheard. Her expression is thoughtful. I eat a slice of Oak's pizza and lick the chocolate off my fingers. It's sweet enough to make me wince, but I don't mind. I just want to sit with them a few more moments before I have to fly back to Faerie alone. When I dismount from my ragwort steed, I head to the palace. I have rooms there now. A vast sitting area, a bedroom behind latching double doors, and a dressing area with empty closets. All I have to hang in them is what I took out of Madoc's estate and a few things I got at Target. Here is where I will live. To keep Cardin close. To use my power over him to ensure things go smoothly. The Court of Shadows will grow beneath the castle, fed on being both the High King's spies and his keepers. They'll have their gold, straight from the king's hand. What I have not done, not really, is spoken with Cardin. I left him with only a few commands, the familiar hatred in his face enough to make a coward out of me. but I am going to have to talk to him eventually. There is no profit in my putting it off any longer. Still, it is with a heavy heart and leaden steps that I make my way to the royal rooms. I knock, only to be told by a prim-seeming manservant with flowers braided in his blonde beard that the High King has gone to the Great Hall. I find him there, lounging on the throne of Faerie, looking out from the dais. The room is empty except for us. My footfalls echo as I move across the floor. Cardin is dressed in breeches, a waistcoat, and another coat over that, fitted in his shoulders, tapered in sharply at the waist, and falling to his mid-thigh. The cloth is uncut velvet in a deep burgundy, with ivory velvet at the lapels, shoulders, and waistcoat. Stitching in golden thread covers the whole, matched by golden buttons and golden buckles on his tall boots. At his throat is a ruff of pale owl feathers. His black hair falls in opulent curls around his cheeks. The shadows bring out the sharpness of his bones, the length of his lashes, the merciless beauty of his face. I am horrified by how much he looks like the King of Faerie. I am horrified by my own impulse to bend my knee to him, my own desire to let him touch my head with a ringed hand. What have I done? For so long, there was no one I trusted less. And now I must contend with him, must match my will to his. His oath does not seem enough of an antidote against his cleverness. What in the world have I done? I keep walking, though. I keep my expression as cold as I know how. He's the one who smiles, but his smile is colder than any stiff face could be. A year and a day, he calls out. Blink, and that will be over. And what will you do then? I draw closer to him. I hope I can persuade you to remain king until Oak is ready to return. Maybe I will acquire a taste for ruling, he says coolly. Maybe I won't ever want to give it up. I don't think so, I say. Although I've always known that was one possibility. I've always known that removing him from the throne might be harder than putting him there. I have a bargain with him for a year and a day. I have a year and a day to come to a bargain for longer than that, and not for 1 minute more. His grin widens, shows teeth. I don't think I will be a good king. I never wanted to be one. Certainly not a good one. You made me your puppet. Very well, Jude, daughter of Matic. I will be your puppet. You rule. You contend with Baelkin, with Roybin, with Orla of the Undersea. You be my seneschal. Do the work, and I will drink wine and make my subjects laugh. I may be the useless shield you put in front of your brother, but don't expect me to start being useful. I expected something else. A direct threat, perhaps. Somehow, this is worse. He rises from the throne. Come. Have a seat. His voice is replete with danger, lush with menace. The flowering branches have sprouted thorns so thickly that petals are barely visible. This is what you wanted, isn't it? He asks. What you sacrificed everything for? Go on. It's all yours.
This has been a Hachette audio production of The Cruel Prince, written by Holly Black, read by Caitlin Kelly, produced by Christine M. Farrell, recorded by Michelle Figueroa, Charles McCrory, and Pavel Rivera, post-production by Christine M. Farrell. The Cruel Prince is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening.
Text copyright 2018 by Holly Black. Audio production copyright 2017 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.